Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today we bring you public policy expert and former U.S. Secretary of Education, Margaret Spellings.
I think all of us here today would agree that education at all levels is one of the most important issues that we face in our country today, perhaps even the most important issue. So I think it's not a surprise that the first speaker chosen for our new program year should focus on that subject, and we're delighted to bring you truly one of the nation's leading experts in the field. Margaret Spellings was the U.S. Secretary of Education from 2005 to 2009 as a member of the White House staff and subsequently as a member of the President's cabinet. She led the effort both to pass and to implement the No Child Left Behind Act, a truly historic national initiative to provide enhanced accountability for the education of 50 million public school students. In higher education, Margaret launched a national policy debate and action plan to improve accessibility, affordability, and accountability in our nation's colleges and universities. She initiated international outreach and collaboration by leading delegations on behalf of the President, as well as overseeing the development and implementation of international education agreements with such countries as China and Russia. Now a nationally renowned speaker, Margaret Spellings is the founding leader of Margaret Spellings & Company, a consulting firm in Washington, D.C. that provides expertise to solve some of the nation's most challenging issues. She also serves as a strategic advisor to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and leads its U.S. Forum for Policy Innovation. Margaret's actually a native of Michigan, but with roots grounded in Texas since elementary school, she holds a bachelor's degree in political science from the University of Houston. It's indeed truly my privilege and honor to present to you a leading voice on public policy and a genuine education reformer, my friend Margaret Spellings.
Thank you, Jamie. It's great to be with you and all my friends, old and new, here in Indiana. Thank you for inviting me to address this august group on a Friday afternoon, a rainy Friday afternoon. You all have been such terrific leaders on this topic that I care so much about, and I thank you for that. You know, my observation as I travel around the country is without an engaged, energized, knowledgeable civic and philanthropic community, it's hard to get reform and change, and you certainly have that here through Lumina and Lilly and all the gold-bannered folks here, not the least of which, of course, is the Chamber of Commerce. And if we don't build constituencies for change and improvement, I'm not sure they will exist. So thank you for your leadership. Sometimes I say about Jamie and all the good work that they've done in higher ed as one of the early supporters, actually, of the work that I did now, I guess almost 7 years ago on higher education, that Lumina was country when country wasn't cool, as we Texans would say. I'm also thrilled that I had the chance to visit with some of your leading educators and policymakers, including your governor, my friend and former White House colleague Mitch Daniels, Tom Snyder, Tony Bennett, the star-studded cast that you have here in Indiana working on these issues. So it's great to be here with fellow reformers. Of course, today I'd like to talk with you about something that we all have a keen interest in, and that's education. You know, it's one of the most fun things about this policy area is that everybody's an expert, right? You've been to school, you've hired people from school, you have kids or grandchildren in school, you observe how well our education system is or isn't serving people as you head to Starbucks or try to make change somewhere. That happened to me recently. And so we're all very much paying attention to this issue, and that's what makes it fun. I know we've all watched with interest the first strike in 25 years in Chicago the last week or so, And these are the sorts of things that catalyze. Almost every day in the front of every newspaper, there's a story about education, about teacher evaluation, about higher ed, about affordability, and on and on. So it's hard not to be an expert in education. Sadly, we are losing ground these days. And as hard as we've tried to reform and think, and you know, there's certainly some good news, we have a long way to go. And it's thrilling to me to see this large audience of people who care about this topic. Of 34 countries that participate in international rankings, our 15-year-old students in the U.S. rank 14th in reading, 17th in science, and 25th in math. This is at a time when we know the jobs are going to be created in many of those STEM, those science and math fields. We no longer rank number one in college attainment as we once did. We've fallen to 16th in the world behind folks like Japan and Korea and Canada. The Center for the Next Generation tells us that by 2030, China will have 200 million college graduates, more than our entire workforce. Now, they got a billion people, too. But seriously, that's something that we need to keep an eye on. We all know well what the unemployment story is in the country, with unemployment over 8%, with 14% of African Americans out of work, which translates to 12.5 million African Americans looking for work, and an additional 2.5 million who've given up trying. We have a skills gap, clearly, with more than 3 million jobs unfilled today, according to the Department of Labor, because employers cannot find the people they need to fill those jobs. The bottom line is our position in the global economy and our standing as the world's leading innovator, as we pride ourselves, is threatened by the lack of capacity to adequately educate our people, especially students of color. We cannot compete with a K-12 system where half of our minority kids get out of high school on time. We can't compete when college tuition rivals family income and average college student debt is about $23,000, and without often the necessary skills to be competitive in the workforce. We can't compete with a scattered approach to workforce development as we have now, a very Byzantine and bureaucratic system. And we can do, and we must do better. We live in a global knowledge economy, and in our increasingly interconnected world, this matters more than ever. We know that our students must learn and adapt quickly. They have to be lifelong learners. They must appreciate diversity. They must be have the ability to think critically and to communicate. So how do we get from where we are, those dire statistics that many of you have probably seen before, to where we want to be? And I want to talk to you much about higher education today, including here in Indiana and the progress you've made, but also how you can be more responsive to the demands of the economy here and around the world. I want to talk about the ways that you might become more focused on outcomes, on results, more cost efficient, more transparent, more innovative, and more in tune with the needs of employers. But I sure don't want to look the opportunity with this many people in the room to talk about K-12 education as well, where I've spent so much time and have the scars to show for it, I can assure you. There is no college or career readiness, obviously, without a K-12 system that works for our students. For the first 40 years of federal involvement in education, we basically had a spend the money and hope for the best sort of strategy. Our federal role since the 60s, since it was created as part of the Civil Rights Movement, was to invest in kids that were left behind, so to speak, poor kids, minority kids, special education students. And we put the money out and hoped for the best, and we had pretty flat achievement. But that changed, I'm pleased to say, in 2001, when the late Senator Ted Kennedy joined now Majority Leader John Boehner with President Bush and passed No Child Left Behind by what really seems like amazing bipartisan margins, especially as we look in Washington today, 87-10 in the Senate. That's not, I mean, I don't think they can pass a resolution to adjourn by that kind of margin today. But maybe those days will return. I certainly know as well or better than anybody that No Child Left Behind has probably become one of the worst brands in America. But I really wear that as a badge of honor. If it hadn't agitated people and gotten attention, I'm not sure that we would have made the progress that we've made. This law armed parents with much more information than they've ever had before. Parents and taxpayers and policymakers have a much better understanding of how their schools are serving their students. These are the same principles that were seen debated in Chicago with the teachers' union in opposition to much of them and with Mayor Emanuel leading the charge to keep those same sorts of principles. No Child Left Behind had a goal, a pretty powerful and, in my view, honestly, a pretty modest goal. It's not the way it's characterized in the media often, but the goal of No Child Left Behind is to get nearly every child to grade level over a period of time, just what we want for our own children and grandchildren. If I came to you and said, look, we think we can get your grandchild on grade level in 12 years, you'd have your kid out of the school, your grandchild out of the school that afternoon. So this idea that what we want for our own kids is somehow different from what others want for theirs, I think is untrue and certainly untenable for our country. This sort of empowerment and information really came to fruition on our national report card. We have seen more progress for the kids who are the focus of the law in the last 10 years than in the previous 28 years of our national report card combined. We had a flat line, and now we're starting to see it tick up. That's not necessarily only because of the law. It's a testament to the hardworking educators and school leaders that we have around this country that we're finally starting to pay more attention to those students who need that attention. Here in Indiana, under the terrific leadership of my friend Tony Bennett, where are you, Tony? Out there somewhere causing trouble, no doubt. You have challenged the status quo, and you've done a lot of terrific things that were not easy to do. The policies like more assessment and transparency, accountability, school choice. You've removed limits on charter schools, created scholarships. It's bold, bold reform, and some of the boldest in the country. I know how hard those things are. President Bush got behind the D.C. scholarship program in Washington, helped expand charter schools by funding facilities, and for the first time ever, allowing federal dollars to be used for tutoring for poor and minority kids that had been left behind. You all have gotten serious about teacher effectiveness, moving beyond just qualifications, pencil paper qualifications, into classroom performance. How well do our teachers do in working with our students? And you're just one of three states, joining Florida and Michigan, that's considering effectiveness as it relates to pay. These kinds of innovation in education are needed to tackle the serious challenges that we have, and you are getting some good results, getting some good traction. But you still have a long way to go. 38% of your white students scored proficient or better, with just 13% of your black students and 17% of your Hispanic fourth graders. So you've started, but clearly there's a long way to go. School districts in Indiana must show results. They must power up on these things, but it's also important that we keep our eyes on the bottom line, on accountability. That's why I'm worried as I look around the country and I see that states are beginning to dismantle No Child Left Behind and the policies that have been put in place through federal waivers from Washington. I think while you all have gotten one here in Indiana, we have to keep our eye on the ball and watch the fine print as these things get implemented. You know, we are in a renewed era of local control. Centralized government from Washington is very unfashionable, and that's fine and dandy. But that means the rubber meets the road in local communities, and the business community has to really pay attention to what's going on out there. Many states are departing from the idea of serving all children everywhere. My own state of Virginia, for example, and this got a lot of national press, was initially approved by the department for vastly different targets for African-American, Anglo, and Hispanic kids, with 78% of white students expected to pass, with just 59% of poor students and 57% of black students. Imagine how you would feel as a parent if your child were held to lesser standards. The performance of subgroups, our keeping our eye on these populations, is so critical to moving the needle forward, and I hope that you all will be paying attention to those issues here in Indiana. When it comes to addressing failing schools, the current view in Washington is that only about the bottom 5% of our schools are really chronically in need, that they're the ones that are on fire. But I worry that is it really possible that with half of our minority kids getting out of high school on time, that only 5% of our schools need help, that the kids stink, but the schools are terrific? It doesn't add up. That's the same conversation, Tony, you and I had today about all the teachers are great, but the schools don't seem to be able to educate the students. It just doesn't add up, and that's why accountability is so important. Today, the rhetoric and the policies are all around college completion and college readiness, higher standards, and that's terrific. But I'm worried if we had a hard time or do have a hard time meeting pretty modest standards, how in the world are we going to meet higher standards? So our challenges are great. When we talk about college and career readiness, there are countless initiatives through the country focused on enrolling more students in higher ed. That's the access piece of the equation. Many of them have been successful at getting kids into college. But now we need to ask how many are getting out, how many are qualified for the workforce. That might not be so bad if we learned that the folks that are getting out of college are fully equipped and fully prepared, but sadly we're learning that many of those students don't learn much after their parents or they invest lots of resources and spend 4 to 6 years to get out. As a result, students who manage to graduate often face skepticism from employers who are dubious of their qualifications. That's why, in an effort to better understand this, I appointed the now so-called Spellings Commission, the Commission on the Future of Higher Education, to look at these issues. We know that the cost of higher education is untenable. Tuition has climbed at 3 times the rate of inflation. Student loan debt is $23,000 a student, surpassing credit card debt of more than $1 trillion. Our financial aid systems, if you have tried to apply for college for your student or worked with a child or grandchild, it's as if we're trying to keep kids out of college, not get them in. It's so complicated. Much of the current debate about higher ed is, as always, about money, and certainly money is important. But sometimes I think we need to step back and be more overt about a strategy. What do we want to do, for whom, and when, and not just talk about grant levels and interest rates and all the wonkery around higher ed. While my commission kicked off some of these discussions, I've been working now with the Chamber of Commerce to continue those discussions. We've released a report that I would commend to you. It's on our website called Leaders and Laggards, and I think you have the page that describes our findings in Indiana before you. We released this report in June, and the motivation for doing this was to kind of keep it simple and better engage the business community in these discussions. In K-12, for the last 25 or 30 years, we've had an active and informed business community, but that's much less true in higher ed. What we found in developing this report was pretty eye-opening. I'm not here to be the doom and gloom, despite what it may seem. I am optimistic. We have the finest higher ed system in the world. Well, we say we do anyway, but I don't think that's the question. The question is it fine enough for the needs of our students, our families, and our society? So with an eye towards keeping America on top, we looked at a few things. We looked at a focus on results. We looked at a need to emphasize quantity and quality. We recognized the need for transparency and information, and we looked at things like innovation. So with respect to results on the report, we found a few interesting things. First of all, our completion rates around the country are about 50%. That is, about half the people that show up in their freshman year actually complete a credential. Your rate here in Indiana is a little better than that, at almost 54%. But the average completion rate at our two-year institutions is pretty miserable, at about 20%. That's why you in Indiana have changed your higher ed funding methods to focus on outcomes by tying spending to results, including completion rates. States also need to do more to make it easier for students to finish their degrees by removing barriers. take students who want to transfer credit from one institution to another. We shouldn't make those students start over. It's a waste of their time, their money, and frankly, our taxpayer dollars often to have to duplicate that effort. We shouldn't make it harder and more expensive for them or for us. Next, states must find better ways to measure not only the quantity, but also the quality. And Jamie and Lumina are at work on this issue. Cost of effectiveness is critical. Leaders and laggards found that 33 states spend more than $50,000 in education and related expenses to produce a single associate degree holder. Here in Indiana, the cost is nearly $86,000, almost $18,000 more than the national average in a place that theoretically is cheaper to do business. Policymakers, business leaders, and taxpayers expect to know a lot more about these costs and a lot more about how productive and efficient their institutions are. I'm encouraged by states like Utah and Missouri, to name two, who are focused on developing performance metrics that focus on these sorts of outcomes. In the Show Me State, they've called for a funding model that establishes common performance measure for all community colleges. The number of hours taught, now that's an input, not an output, for every $100,000 of state aid invested. When we think about focusing on outcomes in education, what is more important than student learning? In reality, there's precious little information available to students and families about what can I expect for my investment. And Tennessee is one of the few states leading the way on this. Indiana, Florida, and Washington State stand out for your efforts to link post-secondary data, higher education data, into your workforce systems so people have an understanding what might I expect in the workplace. And that will help us determine our investment and the effectiveness. Underlying each of these recommendations is an effort to improve transparency because we know that information is critical to empowering consumers. Colleges and universities, sadly, are still too often reluctant to provide this kind of data. But we know if families are going to sink their life savings into these sorts of decisions, they have the right to ask questions like, how well will we fare in the job market? What are the placement rates and wages? Leaders and laggards gave some of the lowest grades to states for these features. But in Indiana, you did pretty well. You got a good solid C. Still work to be done, but way ahead of the pack. Your state's consumer information site called Learn More Indiana links directly to every institution's profile and empowers students and families with information. Other state efforts worth looking at are Minnesota, where they prepared a lot of publications that make it easy and attractive for kids to pursue college. And I'm encouraged that in the aftermath of my commission, more than 300 institutions around the country, including 9 here in Indiana, participate in a voluntary school accountability system to give parents and students more information about cost, class size, and outcomes. I want to pay a particular note to the Lumina Foundation and what they've done around the meaningfulness of degrees. We're anxious to help them meet their goal of increasing completion to credentials to 60% by 2025. That's an awesome goal, and I know Jamie's got his 2025 pen up here. That will not be easy to do, particularly if they're left to struggle through that on their own. Lumina's degree qualifications profile will help us know whether students are getting what they need to be successful. Finally, we need to talk about a recommendation that you in this room, entrepreneurs, business owners, economic leaders, know is so important, and that's the need for innovation, for change, the need to do things differently. Traditional colleges will be hard-pressed to produce more degrees, get more efficient, and contain costs without changing the way they do business. Your involvement with the Western Governors University, for example, an online national university serving more than 30,000 students from all 50 states, is a testament to your state's willingness to try new things. Promising models like Ivy Tech and Tom, your terrific work there, now the biggest college in Indiana, focus on these same policy principles I've been talking about, and thanks for your good work. As I like to say, we are pleased but not satisfied, and we cannot be satisfied. To meet the changing needs of our society, we must become more nimble and more flexible. We must innovate and embrace new ways of doing business. By 2015, the number of students who are taking classes exclusively in physical brick-and-mortar spaces will shrink by two-thirds. Our young people are digital natives, and they expect customized, convenient, relevant, innovative, and affordable education that will help them launch their careers. Indiana, along with states like Florida, Tennessee, North Carolina, Colorado, and Kentucky, stand out for your online learning efforts. Your Indiana College Network is promoting that online learning that provides access to offerings across campuses and facilitates that transfer among institutions. My role with the U.S. Chamber has convinced me that the role of the private sector is critical in all of this. While we've been active, as I said, on K-12, that's been much less true in higher education, and we aim to change that. My experience has been that when businesses know what's needed, business steps up with innovation and calls for support and resources, and I thank you for your engagement. At the end of the day, the Leaders and Laggards Report is to shed more light, introduce more data, share information, red flags, and also herald promising examples. What can we do? And I commend it to all of you. You and the business community define the workforce needs. You're positioned to demand and expect information about performance that will drive our institutions to be more responsive. And you invest, of course, significant resources in your people, your employees, and in our institutions. When it comes to getting America and Indiana back on top and staying on top, you and the business community can send a clear message. We aren't going to get to the top by departing from the promise of serving every one of our students. We must hold firm to our conviction that with an education and a dream, every American can make his or her own success. We have to embrace new ways of doing business and tap the intellect and energy of every single sector. With that, I thank you for your attention, and I'm glad to answer your questions.
Thank you very much, Margaret. Now, we've former secretary and I have talked, so she knows the drill here, which is that let me encourage you to use the white cards on your table if you have a question for her. We've got some in advance. And with your permission, we'll launch right into this.
All right, sounds great.
First question has to do with the question about of tuition. So we know that many colleges and universities, not all of them, but many colleges and universities continue to plan for tuition increases at or near the levels that they've had in the last few years. Are we at a tipping point in terms of tuition in our colleges and universities? And if so, what are we going to do about it?
You know, I heard yesterday when I was making the rounds from my friends at the Chamber of Commerce that in their polling and their looking and analysis at issues, surprisingly, college affordability is showing up very, very high on surveys of businesses. Obviously, economy and jobs, number one, but higher ed affordability, number two, in many regions around this country. That tells you something. And so I do think these increases are unsustainable and untenable. What it means, Jamie, as you know, is that we have to do more with less. This is an era, whether it's K-12 education or healthcare or higher ed or you name it, where we have to figure out better, smarter ways of doing business. There are not, you know, giant revenue streams either coming from Washington or at the state level that can help us sustain this. I think our consumers, and this is to the good of Ivy Tech and places like that, they're looking for value. They now get that you can have high-quality learning at Ivy Tech just as you can at Purdue. And I think the stigma of attending different types of institution is ending just because it's not practically sustainable.
Very good. Okay, next one has to do with the international comparative context. You made reference to this in the beginning of your remarks. It's sometimes said that the reason why the U.S. students rank behind many of their peers is because many nations only educate their best and brightest students, whereas the U.S. Has an access strategy, an attempt to educate as many people as possible. Is there any truth to that assessment, or what do you think about the differing ways in which different countries go about educating their populations?
Well, I think there's truth in it only in the sense that a lot of the nations that we look at are largely homogeneous. You know, everybody in Japan pretty much speaks Japanese. That's, you know, not everybody in our country speaks the same language. and we delight and treasure the diversity of our country. So we are attempting to do something that a lot of people around the world have not. You know, I might say, you know, so what? That's our work, that's our country, that's our fabric. I don't think we're ever going to say, well, we're just going to educate elites because that's what Finland does. That's just not the way we Americans are built, and that's our new task. You know, I said to a reporter earlier today, you know, as we think about educating many more people in our country so that we'll remain competitive, this is something that we've never done before. We really, you know, the day and time 25, 30 years ago when you could make a darn good living with a high school diploma, has changed. That's just not the case anymore. So it's incumbent upon us to do more with a very diverse and often poor and challenging population. But that's the job ahead of us.
So what's your reaction when you hear people in the political context talk about abolishing the U.S. Department of Education? In other words, that this is really a state responsibility and the federal government should not be in that business.
Well, I first try not to take it personally. They're not trying to abolish me. But seriously, I think, honestly, intellectually, there are sort of two legitimate ways we can look at education policy. We can say, okay, we're not going to have a federal role at all, and we're not going to spend any tax dollars on it either, that we're simply going to have let the chips fall as they may, and if communities care about investing in education and getting good results, that's fine and dandy, and if they don't, you know, let them eat cake. I think our country has decided almost 50 years ago now that education is a national priority. I just recently served on a task force that Condi Rice chaired under the aegis of the Council on Foreign Relations that talked about national cohesion, that talked about national security, that talked about the need to have people prepared for our military, which, frankly, most of our kids coming out of our high schools are not prepared for military service or would be disqualified from military service. So I do think we've decided as a nation that is a national priority. So if we're going to spend tax dollars, lots and lots of tax dollars on higher ed or K-12, we ought to get something for it. And we certainly ought to get something for it as it relates to the primary objectives that we have set as a federal government. And that is financial aid to students who need help, to poor students in college and at higher ed attainment, and a focus on results for poor, minority, and special education students largely. Now, we do a lot of other things in Washington, safe and drug-free schools, charter school facilities, on and on, but the giant programs from D.C. are focused on those students, and we ought to have something to show for it on their behalf.
Great. A couple more higher ed ones, and maybe I'll ask a few on the K-12 side specifically. One question has to do with, here in Indiana, 3/4 of a million of our fellow citizens have actually gone to college, accumulated college credits, but have no credential, have nothing to show for it. So with your chamber hat on, what's the responsibility of employers in addressing what is that need in terms of getting those individuals back into school and helping them get a credential, which will help propel them in the workforce?
That is a great question, and certainly not a phenomenon that's unique to Indiana. You know, we see, and there's been a lot of research around this, that students, because they're so unguided, confused, that we don't have very sound pathways to get in and out of our schools. And so consequently, they end up spending a lot of time, spending a lot of money, with little to show for it at the end of the day, with respect to a credential. And I think the business community can do two things. One is we can align the rhetoric coming out of the CEO's office, not just the rhetoric, the conviction and the policy statements that business has with the kinds of practices that are going on in our human resource systems and programs. So if there are employee assistance programs that say pay for your continued education, let's try to do a little of that alignment. Are you going to get a credential, or is it just, you know, sort of a la carte course taking? So I think we can be more deliberate in how we think about that. The other thing I think business can do is, provide pathways. Tom said this. If you're in the community college business in this country, you have a strong relationship with the business community, or you are out of business. And so, better conversations, stronger conversations, and more accurate conversations about what specifically business wants and needs at the aggregated level and at the individual level, and what our community colleges and other providers can do to meet those needs. And frankly, I know that sounds pretty darn obvious, but we're not doing much of that as we should.
A couple of questions here. Great questions, by the way. Thank you all very much. A couple of questions here about the K-12 reform movement. One of them is really a question about why it seems like, for the most part, the reform efforts have been aimed at teachers. In other words, shouldn't part of the focus be on principals and other leaders who really have the responsibility to set the environment for excellence?
Well, of course they should. I mean, I used to say, show me a good school and I'll show you a good principal, or vice versa. I mean, you know that in anything. If you have a good leader, you can be successful, and if you don't, it's hard to. So I do think, we need to look at the issues of leadership, and not just, focus all of our attention on teachers. Having said that, however, a lot of the labor agreements that are in place around the country often do a lot to undermine that role of that school leader, the role of the manager. And frankly, the manager is often more like a line worker in the education business than like a manager. Principals are unionized in lots of places around the country and so forth, so they get sort of blobbed together. And I think we need to start making some distinctions. We're seeing this. In fact, I was in Los Angeles a few days ago, and the superintendent out there is putting into place a new approach for principal pay. They've done this in other places around the country where they're trading off due process rights for principals for very enriched salaries, and focusing the achievement of the principal around results in the campus, which recognizes the role the leader plays, puts our money where our mouths are when it comes to achievement.
So you've been involved in some areas around the use of technology and digital media. What's the role of technology? I mean, here I am trying to review questions on social media. We've got the use of technology changing both teaching and learning, as well as the way we run our schools. What's the role of the digital environment and social media going forward?
Well, I think the true answer is we don't really know yet. We have spent, more than $12 billion on wiring our schools through the E-rate that is assessed on your phone bill every month. I know everybody has a phone in here. And frankly, we have little to show for it with respect to enhancing student achievement. So we have yet to see, the kind of the power of technology and the power of the productivity that can be brought to bear in this enterprise and education as we have in every other area of our lives. That's for a lot of reasons. It's hard to distribute this stuff. It's hard to sell the stuff. There's multiple state standards and multiple purchasers and on and on and on. It's a very complex marketplace. But some things are changing that give me a little hope about that. The Common Core curriculum, where we're going to start to see some critical mass so that innovators and providers don't have to develop 50-plus different sorts of products to accommodate states, will help. The ubiquitous nature of our personal devices, iPads, iPhones, that sort of jump over some of our infrastructure issues, I think could be helpful. And then thirdly, and this might, I hope this won't offend anybody, the fact that we're about to have 4 million teachers turn over in the next few years, replaced by digital natives, our young people who are more facile with using technology, I think will also help us, leap forward when it comes to embracing those techniques. We have to, in fact, there's an example, just going to use one example called rocket ship education. We're in a school, a typical school in Palo Alto or wherever, it's somewhere in California they are, has 21 teachers. At rocket ship, they have 16 teachers and technology. Kids work in larger groups. typically, but they also are facilitated with technology. So bottom line, they're saving money, and the results are fantastic. So we really have to start thinking about how we use people as well as how we use technology.
So, Margaret, we have several questions here around the question of parent involvement and what's the role of parents in the K-12 school system. What role do parents play, and how can we teach parents to help enable results?
Well, my operating thesis at the beginning is always that every parent cares about the achievement of their child. I think sometimes and often they do not know how to engage with the school and with the school community. I used to say when I was in office, my claim to fame was I was the first mother of school-age children, or first parent of school-age children to have the job. Arne Duncan has school-age children, my successor as well. But you would go into a school and they'd be tossing around things like AYP and NCLB and Read 180 and we've got a 360 review. And parents are like, what, particularly non-English speaking parents, what are they talking about? And it's very, very intimidating. You probably have, and you all are obviously a highly engaged crowd, have probably felt intimidated yourselves as you try to engage with some of these bureaucracies. So I think we need to be more welcoming. We say we want parent engagement, but do we really, and are we making it easier for parents to engage? I think technology can be helpful with that. But I do think we have to do a little more hand-holding than we've done with respect to parents. We know it matters a lot. It can't be an excuse for us not doing our job either. I think sometimes it gets translated, well, you know, if the parents would just send us kids who already knew how to read, we'd be able to do something with them. That's just not going to be the case often. And you know, we have to meet the challenge in any event.
So we've talked about technology, so let's take a question from the Economic Club Twitter feed. This person is asking, how do we address the persistent equity issues in U.S. education, and what can be done to what this person is referring to as the deprofessionalism of teachers?
Well, for starters, it's surprising to me, and this is why transparency and information matters so much. You know, right now, if you have a PhD and loads of experience, you are teaching AP at Cream Puff High School. If you are brand new and struggling, you are sent to do the most challenging work in our schools, and we're surprised when we get the results we get. If you're in an affluent community, you have lots of offerings, lots of foreign language, advanced placement, lots of rigor, college readiness, career counselors, and on and on. And if you're, and I'll use my hometown of Washington, D.C., you know, in disadvantaged schools, there's hardly any rigor offered, and what is sort of poorly attended. And then we're surprised, what's the matter? Why aren't the kids college ready? Well, because we haven't allocated time and people like we need to, and that's where, you know, people get real agitated about things, because obviously everyone wants a resourced and effective school and people in it. So I think we ought to start looking, if we're going to be true about this, how well are we deploying our people? Are our best people in our most challenging places, and are they rewarded for doing that challenging work and getting results? And often the answer is no. And I would commend you to look at your staffing allocations, go to those school board meetings and see what this stuff looks like. Because the way it works now is teachers, the more senior you are, you get to say where you're gonna teach. And that's what puts us off to the races. What was the second part of that question, Jamie?
Just in terms of the question of what this person called the deprofessionalism of teachers, in other words, that the profession has been deprofessionalized over time from this person's perspective.
Yeah, and you know, I get that question a lot. That's a tough one. I think, you know, this is sort of one of those can't legislate morality, start in your own backyard type things. I think, you know, we all have to start talking about teaching as the very, very hard job that it is, and you know, kind of do it on a one-at-a-time way. I do think for the most part, particularly since, you know, 5 million people in this country teach, and they're obviously related to millions more, that some of this is a little bit overstated. It's maybe it's like the Congress. I hate the Congress overall, but I like my congressman. Mm-hmm. Teachers are, you know, a big union, but I sure do love the my next-door neighbor who's a teacher. So I think that's a little bit maybe overstated when it comes to an individual level.
we've got time for just a couple more questions. And one question I wanted to make sure we got to is related to this one that you just answered, which this person is asking, so what are we going to do for those children who already have been left behind? In other words, for those in poverty, predominantly students of color, the dropouts, the people who've dropped out before ninth grade, expelled students, incarcerated students, what opportunities can we provide for those students who, sadly, we already have left behind and for which the current system isn't necessarily going to provide the capacity to get them to where we need to be?
And amen. And that is, you know, a really tough nut to crack. For starters, we can stop doing things that are going to perpetuate more of that. So, you know, as I observe states around the country and certainly my home state of Texas, you know, when you start embracing 3- and 4-year-old programs in your public schools, full-day kindergarten, those sorts of things do show some significant results, particularly as those kids are before professional teachers and folks with credentials. So I think we need to stop doing what caused that problem in the first place. With respect to getting kids back on track, I think we need partnerships between our criminal justice systems and our welfare systems and workforce systems, as well as our school systems, to try to tackle these tough nuts. But it's expensive, much more so than you know, getting it right in the first place, as you would expect. And we need to kind of recapture these folks. A lot of that, I think, can be done with this more relevant job training to get people on track. There are some good models around the country, but darn few.
Maybe one more higher ed oriented question. So what's the role of for-profit colleges, for-profit institutions in getting to these national attainment goals? Where do they fit into the equation?
I'm just agnostic about anybody that can do the job I'm for. And we ought to, as I've talked about for many minutes now, you know, transparency and accountability and a good value for the consumer ought to be our standard, whether it's in a community college or a for-profit institution. If people are getting a good value and getting results and getting out, then we ought to be for it. And we ought to have that same accountability standard for everybody, just as we should with charter schools and regular public schools or private schools that get school vouchers. That, you know, if you're going to get tax dollars, you ought to have something to show for it wherever you are. But I do. I think they're part of the solution. They are the people that have reinvented and innovated much of what we see in higher education that the more traditional world is following. It has come externally. This kind of just-in-time, a la carte, convenient, relevant education for working adults has not come, frankly, from our traditional providers, but has come from external providers like the for-profits.
Please join me in thanking Margaret Spellings. Thank you all for being here for today's lunch. I want to remind you that today's presentation will be broadcast on WFYI, Public Radio 90.1, on Monday, October 1st at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and will also be available for download at WFYI.org to be a part of this exciting event. Information and tickets for each of this season's presenters can be found at economicclubofindiana.com. Thank you all very much for being here. Have a wonderful afternoon.
You've been listening to former U.S. Secretary of Education and public policy expert Margaret Spellings, part of the 2012-2013 Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series. Next month at this time, join us for Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Radio in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sharon Alseth.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.